much money can retirees safely withdraw from their nest eggs each year? That's one of the questions that we will address on this edition of On Your Money. And our personal finance expert will be happy to address your questions too. I'm Joy Cardine, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk with personal finance expert Jane Bryant Quinn today on this edition of On Your Money. Our regular financial planner, Kevin McKinley, has the week off. He will be back next week. Jane Bryant Quinn will also have some information and advice about debt, when debt can be useful, some strategies for paying off that mortgage, and we'll talk about what a financial advisor's credentials really mean. Plus, she will answer your personal finance question. What's on your mind today? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us your question at Joy Cardine Show. Jane Bryant Quinn is a personal finance expert, author of Making the Most of Your Money Now. Her column, Financially Speaking, appears monthly at AARP. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Joy, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
And I know you are working on a new book about making your retirement savings last for life, which is coming out next September?
Next September, that's true. I am just finishing the manuscript this month, God willing.
Well, good. Well, good luck with that. And your latest column for AARP is about figuring out how much we can withdraw from our nest egg and still expect our money to last for life. So just the definition, what exactly is our nest egg?
Well, I'm talking about, when we talk about a safe withdrawal rate or how you can make your money last, we're talking about your retirement savings. We're not talking about, you know, obviously your Social Security or if you have a pension or the value of your house. It's strictly the money you have in a 401k, an IRA, money in the bank, that kind of savings. And so you say, how do I make that amount of money last for life? That's what you're looking at. That's the nest egg we're talking about.
Yeah, and in your piece, you describe the 4% rule. What is the 4% rule?
The 4% rule is an absolute classic. It's been around for many years now, and it says that if you take 4% of that nest egg the first year you retire or the first year you start making withdrawals, and then each year you add an inflation adjustment, then your money should last for life. And this is the big thing people are worried about. You know, you retire, sometimes you do it voluntarily, sometimes you do it involuntarily, and suddenly you've got a fixed nest egg, you don't know how you're going to live, and you need to parcel the money out over that period of time. And that's a very scary thing to try to work out. And the 4% rule has become a kind of a rule of thumb of how to do that.
Yeah. What if 4% isn't enough?
Well, there's a couple of things. First, when we're talking 4%, we're also talking about how you have invested that money. Because a lot of people are afraid of the stock market, even though I should point out it has tripled since 2009, mm-hmm. because everything was so bad in 2008 and 2009, a lot of people just said, forget the stock market, and they've been out of it ever since. And that's a problem for, at least for growth, for people who are looking ahead to retirement. However, if you are invested completely in bonds or in certificates of deposit or safe fixed interest kinds of things, then you should be down to maybe 2.5% withdrawal, because that kind of money, you know, fixed interest rates today are not going to last you very long. So when we're even talking 4%, we're saying you've got to have at least 30-40% of your money invested in well-diversified stock-owning mutual funds. And then if that's not enough, if you want to withdraw more, then you're starting to take a higher amount of risk. Mm-hmm. And so you can do two things. You can either say, the heck with it, I'm going to be really safe and I'm going to cut back on my spending, so all I need to take out is 4%. Or you say, okay, I'm going to take out, I'm going to be in stocks, I'm going to take out 5%, even 5.5%. But the second the market goes wrong, then I'm ready to cut back on my spending and take out less next year. So if you're flexible, you can go a little higher.
Yeah. So I'm just, are we, how much money do we need when we die?
What is that? You hope the check to the undertaker bounces?
No, I'm just, sometimes I think about you can't take it with you, too.
You can't. Well, and people have different feelings about this. I mean, some people feel very strongly that they want to leave a legacy to their children. Mm-hmm. And so they will underspend during their retirement years just so that they'll have something left. Maybe it'll just be the equity in the house, but maybe it will be something more on savings. And other people have a different view, and they figure, you know, I educated my kids, they're out on their own, and this money is for me. And personally, I understand both points of view, but I really am sad to see people still pinching their way through their retirements in order to leave more money to their kids. So I think people should live as well as they can in retirement, and then if it works out and their house is worth something and they have some money left over, then the kids should say, thank you, I'm really lucky.
Yes, they are. And we are lucky to have with us Jane Bryant Quinn, personal finance expert, author of Making the Most of Your Money Now. Her column, Financially Speaking, appears monthly at AARP, and our lines are open for your questions, your personal finance questions for Jane Bryant Quinn at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. So Jane, my husband retired just a few months ago, so I am the spouse of a newly retired person.
How is it doing?
Yeah, it's all right so far. It's a little still adjusting to my my sleep cycle. It's
no, but this is something else that, you know, when you're talking about retirement, obviously you know, I'm in the business of doing looking at it financially, so are you. Mm-hmm. But part of the first part of the retirement cycle really is the emotional adjustment. The financial adjustment is important, but the emotional adjustment of what you're going to do when you get up in the morning, what are you going to do? And some people have planned for this in advance, other people have not, but there's a kind of rhythm to this, and it's not uncommon for there to be a kind of a holiday vacation feeling, wow, every day is Saturday, and then to have a little depression set in while you figure out what your new life is going to be.
Yeah, Rob's got a part-time job as a yoga instructor, so he's working on his second career, and he's a good cooker and cleaner too, so I'm very pleased.
Well, that's very good, and the fact that he's got that second career going is absolutely critical for people who retire from a full-time job.
Yeah. And why do you say it's critical?
Because if you, in your job, you were whatever you were. Mm-hmm. You know, you were a policeman, you were had a radio
right.
show, you wrote for somebody. And then when you retire, you look around and you say, wait a minute, who am I now? And that can be a little struggle to get over with. If you're just saying, well, what do? Well, I'm retired. You suddenly say, I've got a little blank in my life. And reasons to get up in the morning, to learn something new, to occupy yourself with something are critical, not only for the retiree, but for the retiree's spouse,
mm-hmm.
as you probably feel. So, you know, people, you don't just retire and, you know, what I call the 3G retirement, you know, grandparents, golf, and gossip. You know, that's not necessarily enough for people these days. And if you don't have something to put into your life, you can become very depressed. Even if the 4% retirement is working for you fine, you can become depressed. I have a relative who is going through this right now, and I know she is coming out on the other end because she's starting to find things to do. But now she thought everything was going to be great when she retired, and then her days were empty, and she wasn't used to that.
Yeah, and he is fortunate. He loves this new yoga teaching profession, and it is keeping him a lot busier than I expected it would at first. But we are getting various opinions on. He has not started to collect any Social Security, 64, and he worked half of the year practically, so he wasn't planning on, and I'm still working, and it's not critical that we don't need it financially at this point. What's your advice to a retiree who as to when to start collecting Social Security?
I think that if your husband can wait until he's 70, that is ideal. You don't need the money now. The 66 is, in a few months, is full retirement age. So if you start collecting before 66, you're going to get, or he's going to get, a discount on his check, and that would be too bad because you know, you're working, he's got a part-time job, you're probably fine. And so if he can hold out until between 66 and 70, your future Social Security check goes up by 8% a year plus an inflation adjustment. And where else are you going to get a guaranteed return like that? So it's a terrific investment, if you will, to put off taking Social Security until you're 70. And at 70, you can get the full maximum Social Security check. It's not reduced by earnings. And if, God forbid, he should die, he is also leaving you the full maximum survivor's benefit, if that would be larger than your own benefit. So there's a tremendous advantage to waiting until 70 before you start taking your Social Security check. And lots of people say, oh, I want to take it now because what if I died early and I would have missed all that money? And I say, sorry, the odds are you're going to die. You're going to live a lot longer than you thought. And it would be better to gamble on the long side to say, look, I'm going to have Social Security and a larger check for all these years and something more for my spouse if I died. And I think that's the side of that bet to take.
We are talking with Jane Bryant Quinn, personal finance expert, author of Making the Most of Your Money Now, a columnist for AARP, financially speaking, at AARP, and we're welcoming your questions for her. What personal finance questions are you dealing with these days? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Jane Bryant Quinn today. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will be back next week. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. What questions do you have about saving or spending in retirement? How about managing debt or finding a financial planner or any other personal finance issue? To the phones we go, and Margaret in Milwaukee is with us first. Hello, Margaret.
Hi, good morning. My question is, I've been paying estimated taxes for a number of years now. I started taking Social Security when I was still working, and at that time then I was required to start paying estimated taxes, and I'm retired for a couple years now. And my income consists of Social Security, my pension, my, of course, required minimum distribution, and some money from investments. And my question is, should I continue to pay these estimated taxes? And if I decide to stop paying them, or can I just decide, or how do I go about that process, whether or not there'd be any sort of a fine or a fee or something if I don't pay?
Now, I am not not a tax accountant, no. Margaret, so I don't want you to take anything that I say on this as gospel, because taxes are a very difficult thing. In my opinion, I have some mixes of income very similar to yours. I pay estimated taxes. If you don't pay enough in tax during the year that is withheld from a paycheck or whatever, and you come in at the end of the tax year and you somehow haven't paid enough over the year, there can be interest owed. So you might owe something because you had not kept up with your taxes the way you should have. So my guess is that you're going to need to keep on paying your estimates, but my double guess is that you should check what I have just said with a tax preparer, a tax accountant.
Yeah, thank you, Margaret, for the call. Donna in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Donna.
Hi. I have a question. I kind of got forced to retire, like, way early. I'm 51. And it was because of an injury, and then they found bone cancer. And I'm going to lose function of my hands. Anyway, I don't have enough to even support me and my two children. By the time they figured out this disability stuff and like that, I had already lost my house. I had gone through a divorce. Just it was like everything was going wrong all at the same time. Yeah. And right now, surviving, I'm living with my mother, and I have a 14-year-old son and a 16-year-old son yet.
Oh, my goodness, Don, I'm so sorry to hear this. And so the question is what to do? Is that?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I can't even afford my bills.
Yeah.
I have storage units and, you know, other things, medical bills that I still have to pay and stuff, and I can't even afford that.
Well, I think you have a safety net because you're moving in with your mother, right? So that you have a place to go there. Your children are clearly, I hope, have summer jobs, after school jobs, or working, and will be paying.
If they receive that, though, Social Security will take down some of the money that I have as an income.
You should see how much they'll be getting Social Security, but you should see how much they can earn still while you can maintain your Social Security check. So there's a certain amount that can be earned. But at any rate, you know that the kids are going to have to be taking care of themselves. You've got the social for their education. You've got the Social Security. And perhaps, I don't know if you can find part-time work or something of that sort. But the fact that you have your safety net of living with your mother is a great thing. Perhaps you should be exploring bankruptcy to get rid of your bills and to start again fresh. I always hate to suggest bankruptcy, but it sounds to me like if you're having bills coming in that you can't pay and you're in this position, that bankruptcy is something that you ought to take a look at.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Donna, for all you're going through, and good luck to you in the future. I mean, we can't necessarily... Jane, what do you think in terms of how many people are ready or not ready in terms of savings for retirement?
I think about half of the people who retire, before they expected to.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of surveys that show that, and it would be, well, and Donna falls into this category. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that you are forced to retire early can be health. You lose your job, your company closes, it's your health, it's your spouse's health, but all of a sudden you find yourself stuck. And at that point, you have what you have. You have your Social Security, you have some disability. Your kids, in Donna's case, have some Social Security until they're older, until they're 18 or 21, depending on what happens. And you need some kind of, you hope you have some kind of family safety net, ultimately. You know, there's not a lot of choice when you're in that situation. If there's anything you can do about finding a way to have a second income, you do that. But this is where families eventually rally around in some way, like Donna's mother did. You know, what are your choices?
Okay. We are talking about your money during this edition of On Your Money. Our guest is Jane Bryant Quinn, a personal finance expert and author, monthly columnist for AARP. And we welcome your questions for her. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. In another recent column of yours, Jane, you write about debt. And we generally think of debt as a bad thing, but you make the case for useful debt. What is useful debt?
Well, useful debt, of course, can be your mortgage or your car lease or, you know, things you need to work or to live or to get around, although I am strongly in favor, if it's at all possible, of getting rid of your mortgage before you retire. Of course, we were just speaking of people who were forced to retire early and didn't have the time to do that. Can I make one more point about that, actually,
yes.
Joy? And that is that when you, if you are one of that group that sees yourself heading for trouble, the sooner you do something about it, the better. The sooner you say, oh my goodness, I better sell my house, or oh my goodness, I've got to cut out the spending, or oh my goodness, I'm going to move in with my mother, and maybe if I have a house and I can sell the house and we can put an addition on my mother's house and I can live there, you know, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. The faster you are able to get your mind around your situation and say, okay, I thought I was going to retire at 65 with more money, I haven't, I need to do something right now rather than wait a long time. But getting back to the debt question, there's an alternative side. You know, unlike people who have, you know, a lot of debts and a lot of bills to pay, there are people who say, especially older people, I'm not going to have any debt at all. I'm going to forget the credit cards. I don't have any mortgages. I can pay all my bills from my checking account, and I am off the grid as far as debt is concerned. But here's what happens, and you don't think about this, because it's so good, right, to be an all-cash person. If suddenly something comes up, say you do want to move, or you want to buy a condo, or you want to make some change in your life, and somebody looks at your credit report, if you have not had debt for a long time, it could be as little as 6 months, it might be 8 months, it might be 10 months, but if you have not been in the credit system, you have no credit score. And when you have no credit score, you are just like an 18-year-old starting out. Even if you've managed credit for 40 years, all of a sudden you're like an 18-year-old starting out, you have no credit score, and it can be very difficult if you need credit or a credit check for some reason. So I always advise people to stay in the credit system in some small way rather than ever going to all cash.
Yeah. So that small way, it might be using credit cards for that you pay off every month.
I mean, you have a credit card. I mean, I put practically everything on a credit card. You know, I put my groceries. I put practically everything on
it. I do, too.
It's a convenient way, right? You can keep track of your spending there, it all is. And at the end of the month, I pay it off. And so my credit score is just fine, but I will always be in the credit system. I will never go to zero.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you have a personal finance question that you would like to ask Jane Bryant Quinn. Our next caller is Nancy in Rhinelander. Hello, Nancy.
Hello.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I have a question for you, and I'm wondering if you can help me. I was married for over 25 years, got divorced, and I had been told that if I waited till I was 62 to get remarried, even if I was remarried after the age of 62, I would be able to collect on my ex-husband's Social Security. And certainly that wouldn't affect him, but it might make my Social Security payment larger. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, actually, I do. And you have been, he has to be eligible for Social Security. So if he's younger than you are, you know, if he's not Social Security eligible, then you, well, actually, you've waited for 2 years already. So yes, at 62, you should be able to collect on his Social Security. But ask, you know, check the amounts, because if you don't actually need it, you might want to wait a little longer, because the earlier you collect, and you can start collecting at 62, but then for any future checks you might want, you're collecting at a discount. So I would have a look at what your check would be at 62, and then I would have a look at what if you waited until your full retirement age, maybe 66, before you started collecting. Would it be a larger check, and would that be worth it for you?
Okay, but it would be like, if my question, I guess, more is about if I remarry. I was told, I've read, that if I, say, I'm 63 years old,
yep,
and I decide to get remarried,
yep,
but I'm not going to collect Social Security till I'm 67, could I still collect off of my ex-husband, or would I have to collect out of my present husband?
No, you could collect, you would have to collect off your present husband, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And while we're talking, I can even check that, because I am working on a book on how to make your money last in retirement, and I just happen to have a chapter that I did on that about, you know, 9 months ago. So I'm going to actually check while we are talking, because I want to make sure I give you a right.
And I'm sure that we will. Yeah, we also are taking a break. I would assume that your local Social Security office also might have answers to specific questions.
You've got to call your local Social Security office on that to make your to be sure, but I am pretty sure you're going to have a choice on that, but I will check it. But your Social Security office is obviously the place to go for help, but just make sure that you ask all of the questions, and that sometimes you go and they say, oh, well, this is what you want to take, and they may or they may not be right about that. I've had problems with God. Let me put it another way. Call twice, so you'll get two different people to make sure you get the same answer.
Good idea. Nancy, good luck to you. And we are getting a number of calls, people who are concerned about our caller who was forced to retire for health reasons and was on disability, Social Security, was moving in with her mom. People are saying, you know, there's got to be some state aid or some social welfare programs that can help this particular woman. And so I'm hoping she will look into that possibility as well. I'm Joy Cardin. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Jane Bryant Quinn, personal finance expert and author of Making the Most of Your Money Now. Her column, Financially Speaking, appears monthly at AARP. Kathy emails, when a person retires and decides to sell their house, is it better to buy a condo or rent something? If we rent, what should we do with the proceeds from the house that we would need to put towards the rent? So Jane, new retirees sell their house, do they buy a new one or should they rent?
This depends for me on how much cash you have. It's very nice to own your house. You can do with what you want to. You know, you can take down shelves and put up shelves and put an addition or not or whatever. You can do what you want, and no landlord is ever going to throw you out. There's your house. However, if you don't have enough cash to maintain your house, to pay your bills, to pay your mortgage, and sort of look out and say, over the next 30 years I'm going to be retired, do I have enough money to pay all these bills, and you feel you're going to be tight, then I would say no. When you sell your house, you can buy a condo, or if you rented, you would put that money into a mix of broadly diversified stock and bond index funds, which index funds follow the market, Vanguard, Fidelity. There are good places where you can do that. And then you have all of that liquid cash that will grow over 20, 30 years. I know people are are really scared about the market. But the American economy has always grown, and it's going to continue to grow, and it'll be bigger 20 years from now than it is now. And so I would trust in American corporations to be doing a good job for you in the stock market over that period of time. So if you rented and you put the proceeds into a mix of, again, broadly diversified stock and bond mutual funds, then you have some money to draw from. It's liquid, and you don't have to worry about ever being house poor, if you will. So my feeling is that, you know, it's fun to own where you live, to own your condo, to own your house or whatever, but it's a question of, do you have enough ready cash to be able to cover everything for yourself comfortably?
The stock markets have been doing pretty well lately. In fact, just a few days ago, the S&P 500 hit 2,000 for the first time ever. How much longer do you expect the markets to keep climbing?
Nancy. I was thinking Nancy because I just looked up the answer to her question.
Okay.
I would never in a million years predict the stock market tomorrow, but I will predict the stock market 10 or 15 years from now, and I'll say that if you're in a broadly diversified index fund that follows the market as a whole, I say Fidelity, Vanguard, couple of mutual fund companies to take a look at, that you will be glad you did. Nothing about tomorrow, but all you want about 10, 15
That's
years.
Good. That's good. And I'm sure you had an answer for Nancy. And
I do have an answer for Nancy. If you're remarried, you can claim spousal benefits only on the record of your current spouse.
Yep.
And if your new marriage lasts at least 10 years and ends in divorce, then you can claim on the record of either ex-spouse. So I knew there was a question where you could take either spouse, but then you have to be divorced a second time, and that is not going to happen to Nancy.
No, she doesn't want that to happen.
You don't want that to happen. You were happily remarried, so you claim spousal benefits only on the record of your current spouse. And again, I would encourage you to claim as late as possible. And if your own personal record is higher, would be a higher check than your current spouse, Social Security will give you your own, not your spousal.
Well, speaking of Social Security, Art in Milwaukee has another question about that. Hi, Art.
Hi. Thanks for the show. Jane, I don't know how much you know about the nuances, but I applied for Social Security starting when I was 67 years old a month ago.
Yep.
Figuring I would get the 8% step up per year for delayed Social Security. And I got a call back from on Friday from the Social Security person who was processing it, who asked me if I wanted to get it just for the month I applied or to go back 6 months and get 6 months back. And I said, well, if it was 6 months back, then I wouldn't get the full 8% step up. She said, no, it's the same amount per month. That didn't make too much sense to me. And then I asked for the figures, and it was only about a 4% step up for the last year, not 8%. So do you have any idea what's going on? So she said you can make an appointment, which would be a month later before I could get an appointment in the local office. She just kept saying this is what the computer shows.
Okay. It is 8% based on what your full retirement account was at age 66. So we sort of say you get the 8% step up as a shorthand, so it's a shorter way of explaining it, but it's not a compound 8% each year. So at 66, you have, you know, X amount is your full retirement, and the 8% is figured on that X amount every year plus whatever their adjustment there is for inflation, and of course there has been no adjustment for inflation because inflation is not there now. So that's why it looks like 4% from last year, but it should be 8% from whatever your full retirement would have been at 66.
I don't understand why does it look like it's 4% if it should be 8%?
Well, look at what you would have had at 66.
And she gave me that number, and then she said,
and it should be 8% up, and that's what the 8% should be figured on.
Well, I guess you have the meeting with the Social Security person, Art, so you can go over it in person with...
Yes, what sometimes happens is, you know, if you're at different ages or at different months, you get a question, oh, it wasn't 8% from this or it wasn't 8% from that, but the 8% step-up is in the law.
I'm Joy Cardine with Jane Bryant Quinn. She is our guest today for this edition of On Your Money. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will be back next week. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Money too tight to mention.
We are talking about your money. We are talking with personal finance expert Jane Bryant Quinn on this edition of On Your Money. Jane is answering your personal finance questions, and coming up, we'll talk a little bit more about paying off your mortgage and talk more about what financial advisors' credentials really mean. And we welcome your questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Bill in Marshfield has been waiting. Hi, Bill.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. I'm 67 and a half, and at age 60, I applied and received a long-term health care insurance product from a very large company, and this was through my financial advisor. Everything was fine for several years, and then last year we got a bill for 60% increase in premiums, which we were told was very unusual. I wrote to the commissioner of insurance here in Wisconsin and got a long letter back basically stating that the company had, as many of the companies that issue these policies, had underestimated their liability and were cutting back. I'm afraid that these products are really unstable, and yet I think that they're still being advised for people. I personally have an investment now of around $50,000 in 7 years, and for both my wife and I. And if they raise the premiums again now that we're retired, we'd have to make a decision to drop it, and we would get no money for our investment, and we've not used it at all. So I'd like to hear Ms. Bryant's comments. I'll take my...
And I just want to clarify, Bill, this is a long-term care insurance policy.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
And everybody was suggesting them at the time, and I think they're still suggesting them, as a hedge against problems later on when you're old and you need care. And it looked like a good idea, but I'm afraid it's turning into a Ponzi scheme.
And it's also, it sounds like it's unaffordable if they raise rates again. Jane Bryant Quinn, what about the long-term care insurance in general and Bill's specific concern?
This is, with some companies, a couple in particular, a terrible, terrible problem. Because the commissioner is right, there are some companies that got a lot of business by lowballing the price. Now they are raising prices by 30, 40, 50, in his case, 60% the premiums, which is just terrible. And it is their legal right to do, which is also terrible. And it puts people in exactly the bind that we're talking about here. There are some companies that have never raised long-term care premiums. So, but they were probably companies that looked pretty expensive to start with. And so then a lot of people didn't buy them. I know of three companies at the moment. One is MassMutual, New York Life, and Northwestern Mutual. And they have never raised, could happen in the future, but they've never raised premiums on existing customers, but they were more expensive policies at the start because they did not lowball their insurance policies. So when you're in it and you're having these huge increases, you are faced with exactly the problem. If you have to drop it or keep it. Now, there's some things you might be able to do. It's a 60% increase for the policy you have. You can do things like, say, wait 12 months before you start paying, and that might lower the price. If you have an insurance adjustment on it, you might be able to reduce the insurance, inflation adjustment, you might be able to do that to lower the price, the premium. So there may be various ways you can adjust the policy to hold the premium down, including the current premium, the 60% one, which you should at least explore. But I guess I'm a believer. I have long-term care insurance, and I think you know, Joy, we've talked before. My longtime husband died some years ago, and I remarried about 4 years ago. But a deal breaker was I want him to have long-term care insurance because my late husband was quite sick for quite a while, and it's very costly. So I'm in favor of long-term care insurance, but the products obviously have to be good, and the ones that are good are pretty expensive compared with the competition, unless you are lucky enough to be able to buy through a company that has a group long-term care insurance plan that you can continue after you retire. If you have something like that available, then you're generally in pretty good shape.
Bill, thank you for the call and good luck. I did want to ask you about another recent column you wrote recently about the alphabet soup that is financial planners' credentials, CE, PC, CSP, CFP, and it goes on and on. What do we need to know about all these designations?
Well, first, that there are a whole lot of people who are aiming for what they call the senior market, and they want to sell you annuities and living trusts. And I don't know. There's a whole long list of things that have very high commissions, and one of the ways that they get you interested is that they make themselves look really, really expert, and they take a weekend course or a month-long course, and it gives them some sort of designation. I'm a super senior specialist, expert, blah, blah, blah. And then they'll have all these initials next to their names. They've certified elder planning. There are all kinds of initials. And the thing is, you should forget about all of them. To me, the only special initials, if you're looking for good financial planning, is a CFP, a certified financial planner, and you want a CFP that is fee only. That means they charge for their time, they charge for money management, but they do not sell you stuff and they do not take commissions. So the CFP is one of them. Now, there's also, in addition to that, there's something called a Certified Retirement Counselor, that's CRC. I like that. There's something called a Retirement Income Certified Professional, RICP. I hope you put all these up, Joy, because they sound like the bad ones, but these are the good ones.
These are the good ones, okay.
And there's a one called Retirement Management Analyst, RMA, and a Chartered Advisor for Senior Living, CASL. I hope you'll put those up on your website. These are groups that have, from my point of view of people who I speak to, they've investigated the kind of study that goes behind them, the learning, the tests, keeping up with current practice. So those are four designations that I am told say, hey, the person who holds them really knows something, plus the CFP. Otherwise, I would completely ignore. In fact, I would be very suspicious of people coming up with other designations.
We will definitely put those on the website. Now let's go to Kathy in Little Chute. Hello, Kathy.
Good morning. I'm wondering how much I can earn. I'll turn 65 in November. I plan to start drawing Social Security January 1st, and how much I can earn in 2015, since that is my full retirement age in that year.
Your full retirement age should be 66, right?
Right. And 2015 will be my full retirement
year. Right, but if you start taking Social Security when you're 65, you're not going to get your full retirement check. Can you possibly wait 1 year? If you start at 65, you're going to get a discount.
I could, but I'm you know, prior to age 65, you can earn up to $15,000, like somewhere in that neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what I'd have to look it up, but it's on the website. But at 66, you can earn the full amount and get your full Social Security check. And you're so close.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is if there's any possibility of you're waiting until 66, you'd then get, you could earn whatever you wanted and you'd get the full Social Security check.
Good luck.
And once you go in at 65, that discount is permanent.
Yeah, I think she wanted to know how much could she earn without. But you say that's not at the tip of your tongue. You can look that up.
No, it changes every year, and I mean I can.
Right,
I
that's
can
fine.
Look it up for this year because I do have it on my in my chapter here, but I can't look it up for 2015 because I don't yet have that in the chapter. But that'll be a Social Security website. I'm just raising the question of if you don't have to do that, I'll wait until your full retirement age if you can.
Yeah, you know, I also wanted to talk to you about another column you wrote not too long ago about paying off a mortgage, generally speaking. You came up with some guidelines to help us decide how to proceed, whether we should pay it off as fast as possible to get that monkey off our back or whether we should take advantage of, take our time. What's the first thing we should think about?
Well, when you're thinking about paying off a mortgage, I'd say the first thing I'd say is, do you have any other debt? Mortgage rates, assuming you've refinanced or whatnot bought recently, we all know mortgage rates are really low right now compared with what they were 5, 10, heaven knows, 15 mm-hmm. years ago. And so if you have extra money, you should pay off any credit card debt. So I would start with that. If you're working and you are not putting the maximum into your 401k or into an individual retirement account and you have extra money, I would definitely do that. And once you say, okay, I don't have any high interest debt, I don't have any, and if you're still paying off a student loan, by the way, I'd do that. You say, I don't have any high interest debt, I don't have any debt, I am putting the maximum into my 401k, and I still have extra money, at that point, I would start prepaying the mortgage with as much as you can. It is a great comfort to enter retirement with a paid-up house if you can do it.
Yeah. We're very short on time, but Jamie in Eagle River, what was your question, if you could be brief, please?
Yeah, I just had a quick question regarding recommendation on, I have a 4-year-old and an 8-year-old, and if EdVest counts verbal versus the Roth IRA for each one, and the flexibility in taking the money out for other things.
Jamie, I'm so sorry. It's more complicated than I thought. I guess he's thinking of a 529 versus a Roth IRA for his kids.
The 529 gives you money that you can take out tax-free to use for college. The Roth IRA gives you a lot of flexibility in saving, and you can take some money out early for college. You can take it out at any time. You can use it for all kinds of things. So those are two different sort of products. I'm sorry we don't have time to talk about them longer.
But I hope you'll come back, Jane Bryant-Quinn, another time and talk with our listeners some more. Thank you so much for being with us.
Always enjoy it.
Jane Bryant-Quinn is the author of Making the Most of Your Money Now, and her column, Financially Speaking, appears monthly at AARP. Kevin McKinley will be back next week. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.